Genesis 5 is a bridge chapter. It traces the genealogy of the chosen Sethite line right through from Adam to Noah. It thus spans the whole period from God's creation of man to his terrible destruction of man at the flood. There are, I think, two introductory matters which I need to mention before we come to the text itself. The first is the structure of the genealogy. With three exceptions that we shall consider later, each person is described in identical terms. First, we're told how many years he lived before his successor was born. Next, how many years he lived after his successor was born. And finally, the two figures are added together, and we're told how many years he lived altogether before he died and his successor succeeded him. True, we are also informed that each had other sons and daughters. We're told that nine times. But all these sons and daughters are anonymous. Only one is named, the man through whom the chosen line was continued, and attention then focuses upon him. Each man's life is described only in relation to his successor. As soon as each son and heir is born, the interest passes to him, and the father is dismissed in a couple of sentences. It's clear, therefore, that what matters to the chronicler is this unfolding purpose of God from generation to generation. The second introductory question concerns the longevity of these antediluvians, which in basic English means that these men before the flood lived a very long time. The shortest life of them all was Enoch's, who lived 365 years. All but two others lived into their 900s, and Methuselah died at 969. Indeed, since Methuselah died, according to our calculations, in the very year the flood began, it seems probable that he was drowned in the flood. And if he died for a natural cause, it's possible that Methuselah would even have attained his millennium. This means that nearly all these antediluvians lived 13 times longer than man's allotted span of 70 years, and Methuselah nearly 14 times longer. Another surprising feature is the advanced age at which these men begot children. Noah was even 500 years old when his three sons were born. We must be immediately cautious, however, about these figures, because we know that in different versions they are not identical. The total period between the creation of Adam and the flood is 1656 years in the Hebrew text, but 1307 in the Samaritan Pentateuch, and 2242 or 2262 according to the Greek version of the Old Testament, the Septuagint. But whichever figures are correct, we still need to ask the question how we are to understand them. What are we to make of this longevity, these long lifespans? Three answers have been given to this question. The first is that a year represents only 1, 2, or 3 months, and that therefore the apparent longevity of these men can be reduced to a quarter, a sixth, or even a twelfth of the figures given in the text. But on the other hand, there is no evidence that years were or could be reckoned thus. Further, such a calculation creates problems of a different kind. It makes some of these men only children when their children were born, and it abbreviates even more the period between the creation of man and the flood. I think we may reject this first explanation. The second is to suppose that the genealogy is not complete or intended to be complete because various generations are omitted. This is not impossible, because other genealogies, both biblical and Babylonian genealogies, are known which are incomplete. For instance, the genealogy of Jesus that is given in Matthew is known to be incomplete, And he does it in a deliberately stylized way, giving three periods of 14 generations. Since the genealogy here in Genesis 5 before the flood and that in Genesis 11 after the flood both give 10 generations, it's possible that the chronicler has stylized them also. If so, the ages of these antediluvian patriarchs are, to quote Delitzsch, the Lutheran commentator, epochs of antediluvian history, which are named after their chief representatives. If these patriarchs had been kings, which they were not, but if they had been, then we might say that these are dynasties rather than individual reigns. Further, if there are gaps in the genealogy, the period between the creation of man and the flood would be much longer than the period indicated in this chapter. The third alternative is to accept the ages literally. And this, too, is not impossible, nor is it altogether inconsistent with the theory that there are gaps in the genealogy. Certainly, long life is a characteristic of man, both in ancient non-biblical legends from Egypt and Babylon, and also in the idyllic pictures of the future, which are painted, for instance, in Isaiah 65. Also, such long lives involving an overlap of many generations would explain the rapid growth of the population. Seth, Adam's son, for example, lived to see Lamech, his great-great-great-great-great-grandson, seven generations later. But somebody may ask, how is it possible for men to live such a long time? It's not likely to have been due to some unusual virtue of man at that time, for although this was the Sethite line, all Noah's innumerable relatives died in the flood under the judgment of God. Rather, according to the biblical narrative itself, it had something to do with the flood. The only men, that is, who are said to have lived to this great age were the antediluvians, the men before the flood. After the flood, a steep and steady decline in lifespan began. Thus Noah, we're told, died when he was 950, but his son Shem was 600, and Shem's son, grandson, and great-grandson all died in their 400s. While the next three generations died in their 200s. The average age of the next two, Nahor and Terah, was 176, and the average age of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, 167, while Joseph died when he was only 110, which already is near the 70 years that is mentioned as man's allotted span in Psalm 90, verse 10. Thus, in 13 post-diluvian generations, from Noah to Joseph, man's lifespan fell steadily from 950 to 110. Why was that? Well, I understand that even today the precise causes of the aging process are not fully understood. But radiation is known to have damaging genetic effects upon man, and if not lethal, may at least reduce his lifespan. If the canopy theory is true, that before the flood the earth was entirely enclosed in an envelope of water vapor, as Venus still is today, then the inhabitants of the earth at that time, before the flood, were protected from the deleterious effects of radiation. And if this water vapor was dissipated or dispersed at the time of the flood, in the deluge, then of course mankind was exposed to these dangerous ultraviolet and other rays to which men had not been exposed before. This is only a theory, but it seems at least a possible theory. That's all I have time for on these two introductory matters regarding the structure of the genealogy and the longevity of the antediluvian patriarchs. Now we come to the genealogy itself. And as one reads it through, what is immediately noticeable is that the monotony, the dreary monotony of this genealogy is interrupted only three times. At the beginning, in its reference to Adam and Seth, verses 1 to 5, in the middle, in its reference to Enoch, verses 21 to 24, and at the end, in its reference to Lamech and Noah, verses 28 to 31. First then, Adam and Seth, verses 1 to 5. Let me read you the first verse and up to the third. This is the book of the generations of Adam. When God created man, he made him in the likeness of God. Male and female, he created them, and he blessed them and named them man when they were created. When Adam had lived 130 years, he became the father of a son in his own likeness, after his image, and named him Seth. The essential truths of Genesis 1 and 2 about God's creation of man are here recalled. First, that God made him in the likeness of God. Second, that he created them male and female. Third, that he blessed them, that is, he gave them reproductive powers. And fourthly, that he named them man because they were taken from the earth. The Hebrew words for man and earth being similar or cognate. The particular importance of this paragraph, however, is that the creation of Adam and the birth of Seth are related to one another. In verse 1 we're told that God created Adam in the likeness of God. In verse 3, Adam is said to have begotten Seth in his own likeness. The same Hebrew word for likeness is employed in the two sentences, and the question is, what is the relation between them? Are Adam's likeness to God and Seth's likeness to Adam the same likeness or different? The only possible answer is both. First, the likeness is the same. God created Adam in the likeness of God, and Adam begot Seth in his own likeness. And since Adam's likeness, in which Seth was begotten, was the likeness of God, Seth must have been begotten in the likeness of God too. The divine likeness in which Adam and Eve were created was transmitted to their children, and so, generation by generation, has been transmitted to us. Although our origin is different from that of our first parents, in that we are begotten, not made, procreated, not created, yet we too, like Seth, bear the image of God. This is biblical. According to James in chapter 3, verse 9, even fallen sinful men like ourselves are, quoting, made in the likeness of God. But secondly, the likeness is different. For the Adam and Eve who became the parents of Seth were not the same as when God had created them. They were now fallen creatures. As a result of their disobedience and of God's judgment upon their disobedience, the glory of the divine image had become tarnished, its purity sullied, and its perfection spoiled. Their mind was now darkened, their heart corrupt, their conscience twisted, their will enslaved, and their soul estranged from God. It is therefore this distorted divine image which Adam and Eve transmitted to Seth. If it had been the perfect likeness in which they had been created, surely we would have read, "When God created man, he made him in the likeness of God. When Adam begot Seth, he was begotten in the likeness of God." We would have had the identical expression. But since instead we have the phrase "in his own likeness," we must conclude that the likeness which Seth inherited, although the divine image, was the divine image as it had been marred and spoiled by the fall. This is confirmed and put beyond dispute by the grim refrain which comes at the end of each paragraph in Genesis 5, as somebody has said, like the tolling of a funeral bell, "And he died, and he died, and he died." For God made death the penalty for sin, And here we see Adam's posterity inheriting this penalty. So it has been ever since. Every baby born into the world is, like Seth, a child of Adam, of fallen Adam. And of each child born into the world, it can be said, both made in the image of God and conceived and born in sin. Psalm 51, verse 5. This is the paradox of fallen man, that he is both image of God on the one hand and slave of sin on the other. And we know this in our own experience. We are estranged from God and condemned by him. And yet, at the same time, we recognize that we are lost, for we are missing our true destiny. On the one hand, we're confined in the prison of our own self-centeredness, and yet on the other, there are within us longings for freedom, which we know to be our birthright. So much, then, for Adam and Seth, and the likeness which Seth inherited from Adam. Now let us jump a number of verses and come on to the paragraph verses 21 to 24 to Enoch. And in a surprisingly unpretentious and almost imperceptible way, the genealogical monotony is again broken. Of every other man in Adam's family tree, it is written that he lived so many years after the birth of his son that he had other sons and daughters, and in due time he died. Only of Enoch is it written, not that he lived, but that he walked with God, and not that he died, but that he was not, because God took him. No doubt, as we're told, like the rest of his ancestors and descendants, he also begot other sons and daughters, but in this ordinary environment of his home and family, Enoch lived an extraordinary life. Both his life and his death were different from those of other men. Take his life. Life for Enoch was more than a physico-social existence. Twice it is written, in verses 22 and 24, that he walked with God. How did this walk begin? We're not told. But since in Amos chapter 3, verse 3, we're told that two do not walk together unless they've made an appointment, we may suppose that at some time, perhaps at the birth of Methuselah, Enoch sought forgiveness and found it. Thus reconciled with God, he began to walk with God. He became the first of a glorious succession of godly men and women, like Noah, his great-grandson, who also walked with God, Genesis 6, verse 9, like Abraham, who was called the friend of God, like Moses, who spoke to God face to face as a man speaks with his friend. Enoch enjoyed communion with God, which was deep, personal, intimate, and rich. And such a walk with God implies several things. First, faith. This is the quality singled out by the author of the Epistle to the Hebrews, chapter 11, verses 5 and 6. Before Enoch was taken, he was attested as having pleased God. And without faith, it is impossible to please him. For whoever would draw near to God must believe that he exists and that he rewards those who seek him. The logic of this is plain. Enoch could not have drawn near to God and walked with God if he did not believe in God, apprehending by faith God's existence and presence and promises. According to Genesis 3 verse 8, the Lord God was walking in the Garden of Eden in the cool of the day, and it seems probable that Adam and Eve were granted a visible manifestation of God's presence. But there is no hint that such a privilege was granted to Enoch. It seems that Enoch walked by faith, not by sight, as we too are called to walk. If the first thing implied in this walk with God is faith, the second is holiness. For God is light, and in him is no darkness at all. And if we say we have fellowship with God and walk in darkness, we lie and do not the truth. The only way to walk with God is to walk in the light, turning from the dark alleys and bypaths of sin. We read later that Noah was a righteous man, blameless in his generation, and walked with God. And we may guess that the same is true of Enoch. If he walked with God, he must have been a righteous and a blameless man. Indeed, by the grace of God, like Noah, Enoch maintained a life of purity and godliness amid the prevailing wickedness of his generation. He lived a godly life in the midst of ungodliness. Faith, holiness, and the third thing implied in this walk with God is perseverance, for we're not told that Enoch ran the race that was set before him, but that he walked with God. His communion with God was no passing emotional phase, but a steady, unremitting plod of years. He went for a long, long walk with God, which lasted 300 years. And long walks require stamina and determination and perseverance. I've no doubt that there were times when Enoch got a stitch in his walk and was tempted to fall out. But he walked on till he got his second wind. And Enoch is numbered among those who shall walk and not faint. The language of every Christian soul is, oh, for a closer walk with God, a calm and heavenly frame, a light to shine upon the road that leads me to the Lamb. So much for his life. Now take Enoch's death. If he didn't live, but walked with God, so he didn't die, but he was not, for God took him. He was not, that is, he disappeared. His family and friends noticed one day that he wasn't around. He was nowhere to be found. They searched for him, but they couldn't find him. And they drew the only possible conclusion that God had taken him. As Hebrews 11:5 puts it, he was taken up so that he should not taste death. Or as Delitzsch, the commentator, has it, on a sudden he was gone, without sickness, without dying, without burial. Now, there is no need to stumble over this in our modern skepticism. The process of translation, by which the body is glorified without the necessity of death and resurrection, is what God originally intended for man before man was sentenced to death for sin. It's what will happen to the last generation, the survivors, when Christ comes, who will not sleep, but be changed in the twinkling of an eye. It's what Jesus Christ could have enjoyed at the Transfiguration if he had not willed in love to return to earth and die. And it's what both Enoch and Elijah experienced. How does it apply to us? Well, not literally, because unless we are alive when Christ comes, we shall all die. But symbolically, God took him is a beautiful Christian description of death. As a matter of fact, the same Hebrew word, verb, is used of death twice in the Psalms. He will receive me, Psalm 49:15, and afterward thou wilt receive me to glory, Psalm 73:24. He will receive me, he will take me. It's like Job's believing affirmation, the Lord gave and the Lord has taken away. And this is how Christians are to think of death. It's not that we die, but that God takes us. Not that we depart to some unknown destination, but that God receives us to himself. Just as Enoch walked with God, and one day went for such a long walk that he never came back, for God took him, so for us, to live is Christ, and to die is gain, since it brings our fellowship with Jesus Christ to its proper consummation. In bereavement, to remember only the phrase, he was not, is to be absorbed in our loss and to increase our grief. But to be able to add, God took him, is to be absorbed in our loved one's gain and to begin to be comforted. So I thank God for Enoch, who didn't live but walked with God and didn't die, for God took him. Both life and death are still transformed by such godliness as Enoch's. The third break in the genealogy is at the end, with Lamech and Noah, verses 28 and 29. For when his son and heir were born, Lamech uttered a prophecy. He called his son Noah and said, verse 29, out of the ground which the Lord has cursed, this one shall bring us relief from our work and from the toil of our hands. The words Noah and comfort, or RSV relief, are apparently not identical in Hebrew, but they are similar enough to justify the play on words. Lamech refers to God's curse upon the ground because of man's sin, involving him in sweat and toil, recorded in chapter 3, verses 17 to 19. And Lamech prophesies that through Noah some alleviation will be granted to men. It is not clear that Lamech was alluding to the promise of a deliverer who would crush the serpent's head, but he does predict that in the midst of the curse there would be a blessing, in the midst of work, comfort, and in the midst of toil, relief. And so it came to pass, for righteous Noah and his family were saved from the terrible judgment of the flood. And Noah thus became the type of a greater salvation, to which Jesus and the Apostle Peter referred. And with Noah God established his everlasting covenant, with the rainbow as its visible sign, that he would never again destroy every living creature by a flood, but that while the earth remained, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night, would continue, and Noah became the first tiller of the soil. I think I'm left now, after we have looked at these three breaks in the monotonous genealogy, with time to conclude by the learning of two simple lessons. The first lesson I learn from Genesis 5 is that God is the God of history. As generation follows generation, and the years, decades, centuries, and millennia roll by, God's people have always been able to say, Lord, thou hast been our dwelling place in all generations, before the mountains were brought forth, or ever thou hadst formed the earth and the world, from everlasting to everlasting, thou art God. Psalm 90, verses 1 and 2. God is the God of Adam, Seth, Enoch, Lamech, and Noah. God is the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He's the God of Moses and the prophets, of Jesus Christ and the apostles. And God is working his purpose out as year succeeds to year. Sometimes, as we read our newspapers and observe the situation in the world, we grow depressed and downcast. Our faith wavers. We wonder if God has forgotten to be gracious, or if he has vacated his throne. But then we survey the sweep of history. We remember God's purpose in creation and his covenant with his people, and we know that his cause will triumph in the end. God is the God of history. And the second lesson I learn is that God always has his people. True, there are those who reject and deny him. Fools, the Bible calls them, who say in their heart that there is no God. But even in the darkest hour, there are some who shine like stars in the sky, godly men and women in the midst of the prevailing ungodliness of the world. And ever since the fall of man, there has been this double line, the ungodly line of Cain and the godly line of Seth. Sometimes they seem very similar. They look, dress, talk, behave in much the same way. They even bear the same names. Just as there is a similarity, even an identity of names, in the two genealogies that were given in Genesis 4 and 5. I wonder if you know, for instance, that the lines of both Cain and Seth each had their Enoch and their Lamech. But Cain's Enoch gave his name to the city which his father had built in defiance of God, while Seth's Enoch walked with the God whom his namesake had defied. Cain's Lamech uttered a curse in a boastful, vengeful war song. Seth's Lamech uttered a prophecy, promising relief from toil and deliverance from the curse. It has always been the same. Men may have the same name, but possess a different nature, walk a different path, and reap a different destiny. As the purpose of God unfolds itself in history, men and women range themselves either on the side of Cain and his descendants, or on the side of Seth and his descendants. Some are godly, others ungodly. Some are warmongers, others peacemakers. In some, the image of God is scarcely discernible. In others, it has been remade through Christ and is unmistakable. God grant that we, by his sheer grace, may be numbered among the latter, and like Enoch, walk with God.